Good afternoon, and welcome to another hour of We the People Radio. Second hour today on March the 9th, 2025. First hour was South Africa. We are now moving on to the Consumer Financial Protection Board. Should be pretty interesting. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
Well, Bill, I'd say, what do we have for sponsors? But it's a lot of random individuals that we're not going to name, and thank you for that.
Yes.
But if your company, product, or I don't know, website or what you call it, wants to be involved in sponsoring the show, we'd love to hear from you. Our contact information is on the website at wethepeopleradio.us. That's usually Bill's job. I hardly knew what came after the dot. I never get to say it. Oh, my goodness. All right, so this hour, buckle up. Buckle up, and I hope you had decaf today, because Phil Kirpin is like the full dose of caffeine. He is a leading free market policy analyst and advocate in Washington, D.C. He was the principal policy and legislative strategist at Americans for Prosperity for over 5 years. Previously worked at the Free Enterprise Fund, the Club for Growth, and the Cato Institute. He is also nationally syndicated as a columnist and chairman of the Internet Freedom Coalition, author of the 2011 book Democracy Denied. He is currently the president of American Commitment, that is dedicated to restoring and protecting the American commitment to free markets, economic growth, constitutionally limited government, property rights, and individual freedom. They engage in critical public policy fights over the size and intrusiveness of government. My, oh my, Phil has come into his heyday, I think, through direct advocacy, strategic policy analysis, and grassroots mobilization. They're working with key partners. American Commitment delivers timely, effective public policy research to the broader free market movement. And they are dedicated to restoring and protecting the American commitment to free market, economic growth, constitutionally limited government, property rights, and individual freedom at AmericanCommitment.org. Whew. Say that three times fast. I'm going to make Bill do it next time.
I'll get ready.
On the fly. So, Phil, we thought, hey, we could talk about the Consumer Financial Protection Board, because your op-ed is awesome, and we have that posted on here. Good riddance to the CFPB. So, for all the people that are boo-hooing about the CFPB going away, why don't you tell us why we're not boo-hooing about it? How about that?
Well, it's it's kind of a miracle anytime any government agency actually ends, and we'll see if
That's
this one
true.
Does. The president wants it to. I think it was a Reagan quote, something along the lines of, "The closest thing to eternal life on earth is a government program." It's a slight paraphrase, but it's pretty close.
I like it.
And it's the same pattern for many decades. Democrats say we need some new bureaucracy. Republicans say, no, we're totally against it. We don't need it. We have too many already. We're not going to. Democrats pass it anyway. And then when Republicans take power, they say, well, we're not going to get rid of it. We'll just appoint a Republican to run it, and then it'll be fine. Then it'll be good. And that's kind of what we've seen with most federal agencies, and certainly CFPB. Republicans fought very hard against its creation back in 2010. They kind of said, look, we, if anything, our financial sector and our banking sector has too many regulators with overlapping and inconsistent rules and regulations and jurisdictions, and we should be simplifying and creating fewer, not layering a new one on top. And in fact, if you kind of look at what CFPB has done in its 15 years, it's not a lot positive, even though, Democrats and the media are trying to kind of score talking points. How dare Elon Musk and Donald Trump try to get rid of this wonderful agency that stands up for consumers? You actually look at what's happened in the last 15 years. We lost 40% of the banks in this country. We went from 7,500 banks to 4,500, and a lot of that is regulatory burden for smaller banks meant they got gobbled up by bigger banks that already had a compliance department and could deal with all of the federal bureaucracies. And so, small banks, a lot of them are gone or merged into some bigger bank now. They certainly haven't, stuck it to Wall Street or whatever they said they were going to do, because the biggest banks are bigger than ever. And you look at what happened in terms of housing affordability, which supposedly this was going to address. It's worse than ever. You look at where, you know, sort of the high-profile settlements, or they've had some multi-billion-dollar settlements. Well, almost none of the money went to victims. It got pocketed by trial lawyers, by slush funds that go to left-wing groups. And so, I mean, I think by any objective standard, this agency has failed to accomplish any of the things they said it would do. It just adds to the regulatory burden. And if we can actually see the elimination of a federal regulatory agency, I think that would be a really positive thing. And so, you know, right now we've got kind of this interesting situation, because the way they wrote the legislation to create this agency, in order to prevent it from being accountable to Congress, they said it doesn't get its money from Congress, from the annual spending bills. Instead, it gets its money from the Federal Reserve Board. And, you know, that means Congress can't do oversight through the annual appropriations process, and a Republican Congress wouldn't be able to cut its funds. But now we've got an administration that wants to eliminate this agency. And so they submitted their official funding request to the Federal Reserve, and Russ Vogt, who's the acting CFPB head, he said, we request $0 for the next quarter. $0 is the correct funding level. And so it's not clear to me who might be able to challenge that or what the next thing is, but I think there's a pretty good chance that in a bit of irony, this agency could at least temporarily be sidelined by precisely the mechanism that was, you know, supposed to prevent Republicans from stopping it, which is this funding mechanism. So, I mean, that's kind of where we are right now. I think that there's a very good case to be made that the agency should be completely eliminated. But at an absolute minimum, I think they've got to change its mandate so that it has to consider the safety and soundness of the institutions it regulates and of the overall banking system the way all of the other financial regulatory agencies do. Because the way it is now, it's just their mandate is just, you know, go fight for consumers, whatever that means, and so they can sort of put any burden they want on institutions. And it's not just the banks, by the way. They've put a huge number of non-bank financial institutions out of business with their regulations. So think checks, cash places, payday lenders, online lenders, that kind of thing. And, you know, a lot of people don't like them. It's a little bit of an unsavory business, but if you put them out of business with federal regulations, then the people that rely on them generally only have worse options, not better options. And
yeah.
So I think that it's been a I think that on the record and on the facts, it's an agency we'd be better off without. And so I love seeing the Trump administration go after it, and I'd like to see Republicans do a little more to articulate the case, because I do think there's a very good case for eliminating it.
Nice. Well, your one note in here, CFPB's mortgage disclosure rules haven't made buying a house any easier or less financially risky, but have added to the pile of paperwork and increasing the closing
now
costs.
Now you have extra disclosures on the pile, and that does what for you exactly? You know, I mean, I know some people read them all, but I think my wife reads them all. I can't. I mean,
I'm going to make Bill read them all. That's Bill's job. Your deal here says the $25 billion robo-signing settlement, for instance, set at almost 6% of the total proceeds to victims. What the heck?
Yeah, I was amazed by that. I got that from Mark Calabria at Cato, who actually has now gone into the Trump administration at OMB. But he had that stat in his book. It's kind of an amazing stat, because you see all these headlines right now. They're going after this agency that recovered all these billions of dollars from scams, and it's like, okay, but the money went to the trial lawyers and the left-wing groups. Almost none of it went to victims.
Yeah. It says here the settlement resulted in mortgages being sold to non-banks with little expertise and lots of incompetence. That's great. That's why I want to have my mortgage.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, almost no. The entire mortgage business now, something like 75 or 80% of it, maybe more by now, the mortgage business is not run by banks anymore. The banks have been regulated and squeezed out of it. So now it's like your Rocket Mortgage and your Quicken Loans and your Loan Depot. I mean, it's you got a bunch of non-bank mortgage companies that are not subject to, you know, all of these new rules and regulations. And, you know, I'm sure they'll get whacked the next time there's a housing crisis. But, you know, in the meantime, what do we do? What do we really accomplish by piling so many regulations on that we mostly squeezed banks out of it?
Yeah. You have a note in here about the auto lending, and
that was the craziest one.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that one actually got blocked. That got overturned during Trump's first term. But this was so crazy to me, because CFPB, the way the law was written, the law basically says you can regulate any financial transaction you want anywhere in the economy except auto loans. I mean, there was like language in the law that says that's the one thing you're not allowed to regulate. So naturally, they tried to regulate it anyway, and they issued rules. And they said, well, we're not regulating the auto loans. We're regulating the financial institutions behind the auto loans, and somehow that gets us around the prohibition in the law, which, you know, we'll never find out if that would have flown because Congress blocked them, but I thought it was a very dubious legal theory. But to me, this regulation was so crazy because what they said basically was, we think that auto dealers are racist, and they're not making enough loans to black people. And so we need to regulate them. But the thing is that all of the auto purchase data we have does not have race in the data. So what they said is, we don't have any race data, but what we're going to do is we're going to take the auto purchasing data that we do have, and we're going to guess what the race of each borrower was based on their zip code and their last name. And then based on our guesses of what the race was, we're going to decide whether you were racist or not and need to have, you know, fines and regulations imposed on you. This was the logical chain that they tried to use for regulating the one thing that the law said they weren't allowed to regulate. And, you know, that did get overturned by Congress, as I said, and so that never took effect. But I think it tells you a lot about just sort of the craziness of in how left-wing this agency became that they even attempted something like that.
Oh, yeah. And they used the Congressional Review Act. Can you kind of share with people how that would roll? Because I know we're in the process of that again.
This is a big deal right now. Yeah, this is a big deal right now because the Congressional Review Act was part of the contract with America back in the 90s. And this is a law that gives Congress the power to overturn any federal regulation and prohibit a substantially similar regulation from being imposed. And they can do it with a majority in the House and Senate. It cannot be filibustered in the Senate. And, you know, as you know, there are not that many privileged mechanisms that exist in the Senate, which is why usually the minority party in the Senate can block most things from happening. But this procedure allows, if you have a majority in the House and Senate, you can get to the president's desk a bill to overturn and ban any individual federal regulation. Now, the thing is, if you do this in the middle of a presidential term, the president who just issued the regulation will veto your bill, and, you know, unless you somehow have two-thirds in the House and Senate, which is almost never going to happen, then you've accomplished nothing. But if you have a change in the White House, if you have a presidential election in the middle of the review period, and the review period is 60 legislative days from when the regulation is made final, so they can go back basically to August 12th, I think, of last year, or August 16th, sometime in mid-August, that 60 legislative day window opens up. If you've had a presidential election in that window, now you've got a new president who might be willing to sign laws banning the old guy's regulations. And so at the beginning of Trump's first term, I think Congress did 17 of these, and one of them was this auto lending rule from the CFPB. So that was overturned and banned. That was an Obama regulation that was overturned and banned in the first Trump term. The Trump was able to sign that when Congress overturned it. And Congress right now is in the same situation. You've got a Republican Congress that has a Congressional Review Act window that goes back into August of last year, and you've got a new president who's willing to sign things. And so we've now seen a number of these this year. I'm not sure if they've done any that are CFPB-related, but they've done a bunch of Department of Energy and EPA ones that are kind of interesting on things like the ban on gas-fired tankless hot water heaters that Biden passed. The House has passed a bill to overturn that. Senate's probably going to vote soon on that, and there have been a bunch of others on appliance standards and other things. So I don't think any have made it to the president's desk yet, but he'll probably get 10 or 15 of these again this year. And these are much better than just having the agency reverse, because if you get Congress to reverse it, then a future Democratic administration can't just put it back in. You've actually got a prohibition written into law. So Congressional Review Act can be a very useful tool, but it's very limited in scope because, as I said, other than the circumstance where the control of the presidency changes during the window, you're just going to have the same president who issued it vetoing your bill to overturn it. So one of the things I've been trying to do for the last, 15 or 20 years now, is actually reverse that process. So instead of Congress voting to overturn federal regulations, they'd have to actually vote to approve federal regulations before they could take effect. And if we had that process, I think we'd stop almost all of the very worst regulations, except when the Democrats have huge majorities. So If we accomplish nothing else in this presidential term, getting that done would be a really big deal, so we don't just have this pendulum swinging back and forth.
Yeah, that's always the worst part. They come in with the big pen and, you know, then the big eraser and then the big pen and the big eraser.
Right,
and it's
right.
Like people feel like they have whiplash because they think these are laws that are being passed. It's like, they were laws, it'd be so much slower. So then there's stuff they really want, and it takes forever.
All this stuff that Trump is doing, and it's very important for people to understand the point you just made. All the great stuff you see Trump doing, all the executive orders, everything that it's all temporary unless he gets Congress to approve it. Unless he gets them to put their stamp of approval on all of these things, I mean, they're gone as fast as they came. I mean, Biden put back every crazy Obama regulation and then some, other than the handful of ones that Congress overturned. But, you know, I thought Obama was going to be the world's worst, most expensive regulator. And Biden blew past him pretty easily.
Well, so he grew the bureaucracy by like 30%. So we're looking at we're looking at whittling down what Obama brought in. Just before we take a quick break here, the one regulatory thing that I can think of that most people did follow instead of all the, I mean, people should care about the other ones too. But the one that was big is when Trump said no more men in women's sports, and then Congress tried to pass a bill to make that a real deal, and all the Democrats voted against it.
So yeah, wasn't that amazing?
Yeah, so that was not codified in law. So that is only hanging as an executive order. So conceivably 4 years from now, if people feel the need to vote in another Democrat, odds are they will erase that
it'll
EO.
Get reversed.
And
well, I don't know. Your governor says he's totally against men and women's sports now. So
yeah.
I'm surprised
go figure that out. That guy.
I think we already know what that's about.
Yeah, he's the original Penny, got a face on both sides. All right, quick break. We'll be right back with our guest, Phil Kirpin. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Compliance. We just need your compliance. You will feel no pain anymore. No more defiance. We just need your compliance. Just give us your compliance. We won't let you feel lost anymore. No more self-reliance.
Indeed. And if we just regulate it some more and everyone would just comply,
yeah,
it'll all be so much better. Oh, my gosh. I liked your note in here. The chain of regulating everything might sound good until you realize that it's precisely why small banks are disappearing. And big banks are increasingly putting fees on everything. If they get rid of the CFPB, Phil, Does that reverse, or has the day of the small bank gone away?
It's a good question because most of the rest of the world is in a much worse place than we are in terms of bank consolidation. I think there are only like 5 banks left in Canada, something like that. So
wow.
We say we have 4,500. It's it's not like the 10,000 we used to have, or even the 7,500 we had 15 years ago, but we're still doing better than a lot of places. And so it's sort of, to what extent can we reverse some of this with having lower regulatory burdens, and to what extent is it, factors that are bigger than that? I don't know. But I do think that, if we could deregulate, lower the regulatory burdens, lower the compliance burdens, and, maybe besides, I think we need more bank deregulation, or at least simplification, than just getting rid of CFPB. We also just have to make the process of opening a bank much easier, because we used to have new banks open all the time. Now, the last few years, we basically had zero, which tells you there's something very wrong in that process that we've got. And so, I mean, I think that's kind of like a broader discussion that you need to involve Congress in, is sort of, you know, do we have too many bank regulators? Do we make it too complicated? I think the answer is yes to all of that. Now, if you fix all of that, do you get a huge boom in new banks starting? I don't know. But you get some. You're not going to be stuck on zero like we have in the last few years. And so if the long-term trend continues to be kind of downward, I think we can at least slow it, and we can at least relieve the regulatory burdens that have become so much of a problem for smaller banks and non-bank financial institutions also. And I think this is really critical, because one of the things that happened a lot in the Biden administration is they basically tried to destroy non-bank financial institutions with all kinds of rules and regulations for storefront lenders and online lenders and different crypto exchanges and so forth. And I think that under Trump, you're going to see a much more favorable environment for non-banks also, which is crucial for people kind of at the lower end financially, because a lot of them rely on non-banks. And a lot of them, you know, maybe they're paying relatively high fees and what have you, but they have a relationship with that storefront place, and, you know, they get taken care of there. And if you force it to close, they're not really going to have somewhere else to go. And so I think that there's sort of this two-tiered financial system that's developed is something we can kind of reverse if we can lower the regulatory burden.
Well, and so just for the, you know, what's the hype going to be, you know, about if we get rid of the CFPB, you know, are we all, what's the cliff we're all going off of that they're going to try to sell to people?
Well, what they're trying to say is, they're trying to say without the CFPB, the banks will be totally unregulated, and they'll rip you off and charge you outrageous fees and all this kind of thing. And it's kind of like, well, first of all, a lot of that happened even with the CFPB. So I'm not sure that was the key that was saving everyone. But second, you know, the challenge that we have in our financial services regulations, not that we have too few regulators, it's that we have too many. And you don't know where to go when there's an issue, and they have overlapping rules, and sometimes banks are put in a position where they're going to have to violate one agency's rules or another because they're contradictory. And it's not like if you get rid of CFPB, there's no financial service regulators. You still have, you know, you still have the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency and the Federal Reserve Board and the FDIC, and you still have the SEC if it's a publicly traded company. And, you know, it's there's still a laundry list of federal regulators that are supposed to be overseeing all of this stuff. And then you got your state regulators as well, and you've got, of course, the trial lawyers licking their lips to bring another class action suit anytime one of these institutions missteps. And so I think that they're going to go with, oh, my God, they'll be unregulated, and everyone will be at their mercy. And it's kind of like, well, no, they're still going to be very heavily regulated. And, in fact, you know, maybe if we can rationalize the regulation a little bit, have less duplicative and contradictory regulation, we can have, you know, simpler rules that can be understood and enforced a little bit better. And so I think the line they're going to go with is, oh, my God, consumers are going to be unprotected. I don't think it's a very convincing one.
Because it's only been around for how long? 12 or?
15 years.
15 years? Yeah, so before that, I don't think it was exactly the Wild West in the banking industry. They claim, I did hear them claiming that all our credit card fees and all that stuff were just going to skyrocket.
Yeah, well, I mean,
and I was like, of course, well, they're already like 30% if you don't pay your bill off every month. I mean, carrying a balance is already exceedingly painful.
Never carry a balance unless you have no other option.
Right.
Is what I tell people.
It's never been a good way to go, but, I mean, it just seems
the thing is,
that's gotten a lot worse.
Okay, and I agree with you on that. It's never a good way to go. But then you got people like this congresswoman from Florida, Anna Paulina Luna, signed on to a bill with AOC to prohibit credit card interest higher than 10%. Now, if you do that, most people are going to get their credit cards canceled because, you know, it's an unsecured loan. They have no recourse, really, if they go delinquent. And, you know, in order to justify the risk of lending unsecured loans with the kind of credit limit that most people have, there has to be a big interest rate attached to it. So, it would ban credit cards for most people. Now, you might say, good, that's a good thing. Most people would be better off without credit. They can use debit instead. They won't spend beyond their means. And that's not totally wrong. I have some sympathies for that. The problem is there are often situations in life where even though it's expensive, you don't have any other better option. Some big unexpected expense comes up. You're not going to bridge it until you get some payday or, you know, some, you know, you're waiting for something to happen. I mean, there things happen in life. And sometimes expensive money is better than not having access to money at all. And, you know, I think you're just going to create a lot of much worse circumstances for people if government steps in and says we're basically going to ban this whole class of products, at least, you know, for large groups of people.
Yeah, that's a tough deal because then you're down to people are reduced to dealing with loan sharks, I guess, because...
Basically, if you're in a state that already banned payday and then the feds banned credit cards, I mean, what's left? I don't know, nothing good.
Yeah. I don't think that's what they had in mind, but the fact that, you know, Elizabeth Warren was so tied up in this and we have Luna and AOC working on it, I mean, honestly, three of the... not smartest people I can think of right off the top of my pointed head would be those three.
Well, in the Senate, it's Bernie Sanders and Josh Hawley. So they've got one Republican at least in both House and Senate on this idea.
That's too bad because I would say Josh Hawley's pretty smart. Bernie, of course. Well, there's another.
Well, Josh Hawley is a very, very smart guy, which actually makes him more dangerous.
I know. That's what's terrifying. What's he supporting this? What's his thought process in this, you know?
I suspect that he is well aware that the vast majority of people would no longer be able to have credit cards if a 10% rate cap were in effect, and he probably thinks that's good. Force people to live within their means. They can use debit, and, you know, if you need to buy something, you save up for it or something like that. I mean, there is this strand of conservatism that says credit's a bad thing. I just don't subscribe to it.
Well, I mean, if you live in a world where you think choices are important, and that people are adults and they should be able to make their own decisions, taking choices away from people then doesn't fit the narrative. You know, we're not being treated like children.
More to the point, I mean, how do we spend all that? You know, how do we go nuts every time the Democrats propose a price control, and then say, oh, but this price control is good? You know,
That's true, and I'm with you on that one. I don't think that's a great idea. So, how likely is it that you think they're going to get rid of this? I mean, if they've requested zero budget, that seems kind of like a green light, right?
I think the chances are very high that this agency's activity level can be reduced to zero or near zero for the duration of the Trump presidency. I think it'd be difficult to come up with strong legal arguments against it. There is a little bit of a challenge in that, you know, some of its sort of, you know, consumer complaint collection and response type functions that used to reside in other agencies probably can't be returned to their original agencies just through executive action. You probably would need Congress Act, which makes that a little bit challenging. But I think that for the most part, you know, they can stop all of the lawsuits and the enforcement activities and kind of the promulgation of new regulations. The big question is, you know, does it just, as we were talking about before, does it just spring back to life full force when the Democrat comes in and says, hey, Fed, we need $1 billion or whatever? Or does Congress get around to, you know, passing a bill that says we're going to close this down, send its functions back to the original agencies and so forth? So if Trump just does what it looks like he's doing on his own, I think you can have a presidential term where this agency is largely sidelined. If you want to actually permanently reduce the number of regulatory agencies and disprove Reagan's eternal life on Earth quip, that's much more difficult. That probably requires Congress.
Yeah.
Well, it gets back to that 60 votes, you know.
Very hard to do anything there.
That's the tricky part.
A reconciliation bill with the 50, but yeah, it's very difficult to get things done in the Senate. And I thought the Democrats were maybe going to kill the filibuster like they did for nominees, but they didn't. And Republicans are too institutionally cautious to do something like that themselves. It's hard to get things through the Senate, even when you're in the majority.
Yeah, and that's. That's why the budget reconciliation and all that is so important. They only need just that.
It's critical, yeah.
50 plus one. So
and if you want to shift gears a little bit to tax, I mean, the one thing that Trump absolutely cannot do without Congress is tax policy, which cannot be done by executive means or regulatory actions or what have you. It only gets done by Congress. And we're staring at a situation now where, because of the way they wrote the 2017 tax bill, almost all of the tax cuts were only passed through this year. And so if they don't get a tax bill done this year, we're looking at a $4 trillion tax hike come January 1st, an average of about $3,000 per household, the standard deduction being cut in half, all the rates going up, the small business tax rate in particular going from under 30 to over 40, which is just going to hammer small businesses. And so this is sort of the big economic sort of Damocles hanging over the U.S. economy right now, is this huge tax hike and kind of this ticking bomb that's going to go off at the end of the year if they can't get it done. And we've got a House and Senate right now, even though they're both run by Republicans, that are on totally different pages strategically on this. We've got House and Senate budgets have passed, but they couldn't be more different. The House did a budget that had room for major tax extenders, not just of the things that were expiring, but also of no tax on tips, no tax on Social Security, no tax on overtime, those key new tax promises from the president. And the Senate did a bill with literally zero tax provisions. The Senate did a budget that has no tax instructions at all, that does nothing on tax. And then the Senate Republicans, I mean, I don't have the nerve on these guys, they said, well, we're against the House budget because the House budget probably, with the numbers in there, probably can only get to a 7 or 8 year extension of the Trump tax cuts, not a permanent one, and we only support permanent. This is what the Senate Republicans are saying. And then you got to scratch your head because they're saying, because you're like, okay, they say they only want permanent, but they're doing a budget with no tax.
But they don't advance anything. Yeah, that's helpful.
Yeah, they're doing nothing at all on tax. They're trying to say, oh, well, let's do a budget now with nothing on tax, and then we'll do a second budget later this year that'll address it. By the way, do you know how many times the U.S. Senate has passed two budgets in the same year in its history? Because I think it's zero.
I
don't
believe
such a thing has ever been done.
My God,
so it's like, oh, yeah, we'll do another budget. No problem. We'll do another budget later this year. Will you really?
Yeah.
No, I mean, not known for doing extra work there in the Senate. So, I mean, I would like to see the Senate take up the House passed budget so they can get onto a tax bill sooner rather than later. And I'm hoping the president will start leaning on them, because I really don't know. And by the way, I agree with them that permanent would be much better than 7 or 8 years for the extension.
But we could stop doing
doing nothing on tax. You want to take the House one up, amend it to allow permanent and send it back. I'm all for that. But, I mean, to just say, hey, we did our budget and not take up the House one when your budget has nothing on tax, it's a little crazy.
It does seem a little crazy. And so let's take our break, and then when we come back, I want you to explain to people. It's kind of funny because what we've been hearing since that tax bill went through is it was a tax cut for the rich. But the funny part is if that tax bill expires, everyone's getting a tax increase.
Mm-hmm.
So wait, that means everyone got a tax break? Wait, what? So maybe you could give people a little bit more data on that, because it's we're back to the tax cut is only for the rich, blah, 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 which is, you know, totally false. Anyway, our guest is Phil Kirpin. He is the president of American Commitment, and you can find them at AmericanCommitment.org, and we have them linked up on our website at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
To be free to keep what I earn, to decide what my kids learn. What I consume shouldn't be the lawman's concern. To be free, to speak my mind, to believe as I'm inclined, without Big Brother driving by to keep me in line. All the gold in somebody else's name. So if you're dreaming about California, it don't matter at all where you played before. California's a brand new
game. Brand new game.
Oh, my God.
Every day it's a brand new game. You can change your mind and say something totally different.
Bill, you could play in girls' sports.
Yeah.
You would look snappy in a skirt.
Thanks for that. You said you'd never tell.
You have an outfit made for radio. I'll tell you all about it later. Anyway, what the heck? Okay, so back to you, Phil.
I don't know what to say about that.
I get a D in segue. Sorry. It's the time change, you know? I just feel like it's like the whole day is all screwed up. It's like steal an hour from you, and you're just all, you know, upside down.
That's not right.
But I have to hand it to you and to Harry. In the first hour, we all got the time right. We all showed up on time.
I know Trump wants to get rid of it, but I like the time change, to be honest.
Oh, you do?
I like that extra hour in the evening. I do.
Oh, man.
You get another hour of daylight. You can do stuff. You can get the kids outside. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's the switching. It's like pick a team, you know?
Yeah, leave it the way it is.
Like, let's just pick a side and be on it. I don't know. It's funny.
But he can't figure that out. Dev, you notice he can't figure that out? He says, we're going to get rid of it. We're going to stick the club. But then he's like, but half the people want it. One half want it the other way.
Yeah, the morning people.
That's how we ended up switching back and forth, right?
I mean, that's right. We're right back to where we started.
Half the morning people want one team, and the night people want the other team. It's like, yeah, what the heck. So, oh, my gosh. I got us all distracted. I got myself all distracted. What were we going to talk about?
I don't know. We just talked about the tax bill.
Why is the tax bill a good thing for regular people?
We're staring at, contrary to this talking point about millionaires and billionaires, the 2017 tax cuts were actually tilted towards middle and lower income people. And what I mean by that is, the share of income taxes paid by the top 1% and by the top 5% and by the top 10% all went up. They did get larger tax cuts in dollar terms, but that's basically always going to be true if you're cutting the rates for everyone, because people with the very highest income, it's sort of unbounded. But if you look at the shares, the amount of tax, the burden now falls more heavily on the top than it ever has in the history of our country, and that's because you look at the actual provisions, which are set to expire, and they include things like the standard deduction. The standard deduction is going to be cut in half from, $31,000 to $16,000 if the tax cuts expire. And so if you're not an itemizer, if you don't have a mortgage to itemize or a bunch of other things to itemize, you come out way behind. If you do have to itemize now when you didn't before, you might make up some of that difference, but at the headache-inducing need of figuring out all your itemization and entering it all into software, or God forbid, writing it all out on paper. So the halving of the standard deduction is a big deal. The child credit gets cut in half from $2,000 to $1,000. That hits lots of people who are not particularly wealthy. All of the income tax rates go up, so no matter where you are in the ladder, you face higher rates. The alternative minimum tax springs back full force. Very, very few families are paying that right now because of the reforms in 2017. That comes back. And by the way, there's been a lot of talk about how capping the state and local tax deduction was so bad for people in high-tax states, but most of the people who really benefited from that didn't benefit from it, because the alternative minimum tax took it back from them anyway. And if the AMT comes back, then relief from that SALT will be kind of meaningless, because you get hit by the alternative minimum tax. The death tax exemption gets slashed in half. It gets slashed in half from, I think it's $14 million now, it goes down to $7 million, and that's a big deal for family farms and businesses. That means that, millions of family farms and businesses that are currently below the exemption amount would have to figure out how to plan around or deal with or sell the family business when the founder dies. And so that one is a really big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the small business rate, which I mentioned. And not everyone really understands how this works, but it's not just that the top income tax rate was cut from 39.6 to 37 in the Trump tax cuts. There also was created a 20% exclusion called Section 199A, specifically for small business income. And so small businesses are paying just under 30% now because it's 37 is the statutory rate, but you get to exclude 20% of your small business income, and so it's like 29 point something is what you're actually paying on small business income. Well, if you get rid of the 20% exclusion because the Trump tax cuts expire, and you raise the rate from 37 to 39.6, and you may be subject to the surtax, the net investment income surtax from Obamacare, well, you're talking about going from around 30% to 40% or more on small business income. And by the way, I don't know why exactly it was done this way, but the corporate tax rate, the 21%, that's permanent. That doesn't expire. And so if Congress fails to act, the corporate rate continues at its lowered rate, but non-corporate businesses get this massive tax hike. So I mean, their ability to compete will be dramatically harmed. And that's not the rich of the rich. That's an awful lot of middle-income people that have just, you know, been able to run their own business.
Yeah, and who's going to pay for that?
Yep. Oh, the consumers. Gets passed on, every bit of it.
I mean, they'll have to. Otherwise, those people go out of business, at which point the consumers still pay for it because now a bunch of them don't have jobs. Yeah, I think there's a lot of bitterness.
They raise their prices or they get sell the thing, and they, you know, your mom and pop becomes, you know, not a mom and pop.
Yeah, anymore. Yeah, it becomes a box store. And people have a lot of, I find there's a lot of, honestly, just jealousy about business owners. That somehow they think these guys are just sitting on their hands and sliding uphill. You know, it's, what a deal.
Well, look, a lot of people hate big business, which I kind of get. And, you know, we all remember during the COVID lockdowns when somehow, like, you know, your neighborhood hardware store was super dangerous, but Home Depot could be open because, you know, I don't know. I mean, just it was just the most blatant kind of like,
yeah, which made no sense.
If you've got the lobbying stroke, we'll exempt you. Otherwise, we're going to stick it to you. So, I mean, look, there's a lot of reasons people are resentful towards big businesses. But, you know, big businesses are almost all corporate. They almost all have a corporate form. And so, like, when Democrats say we're not going to extend the tax cuts, what they're basically saying is we want the tax advantage for large corporate businesses to be massive over small businesses that pay on individual tax returns. That's, like, a little crazy. And I don't know how you defend that.
I don't either, and I think it's. I think actually the way you defend it is you just make sure nobody actually knows how it works. You know, you just obfuscate and continue to lie about it and hammer the talking points.
Remember the last segment I mentioned that the Senate Republicans did a budget with zero tax instructions at all?
Yes.
And they said we're going to do tax later in the year. Well, every Democrat led by Chuck Schumer, do you know what they talked about in the floor debate over that budget? They said, this budget is a giveaway to millionaires and billionaires. It's tax cuts for the rich. There were literally zero tax cuts in the budget. None. They didn't even have a tax instruction anywhere in the budget. And they still use that same talking point anyway, which tells you, like, they're completely obsessed with this talking point, even when it has zero connection to anything. It's, even when they're debating a budget that does not touch anything related to tax, that's all they can talk about.
Well, they also said that it was cutting the thing they passed. The resolution also cut Medicaid and Social Security and SNAP and veterans benefits, except none of those things were in there either.
By the way, your state is ripping off the rest of the country on Medicaid absolutely insanely. Okay, in Newsom's current budget for this upcoming fiscal year, he's expecting $119 billion of federal Medicaid funding, which is more than the entire state budget of the state of Florida. And so I said, okay, well, I'm very excited. The Republicans are cutting Medicaid. Maybe they're going to cut that number to something. Maybe, you know, it's doubled in the last 5 years. So I'm thinking, okay, maybe they're going to go back a year or two. Maybe they'll at least go to $100 billion. They're not getting. So I asked the top budget expert I know, Paul Winfrey from the group Epic. I said, okay, what does the Republican budget do to the $119 billion that Newsom's expecting this year? And he said, oh, no, it doesn't touch that. That doesn't. But the year after that, under the Republican budget, it would only go up to $122 billion instead of $125 billion under the baseline.
Oh, my gosh.
And I said, okay, now wait a second.
The
so
evil.
It's doubled in 5 years, and the so-called cut that Democrats and the media are going insane about is that it only increases 3% the next year instead of 5%. And he's like, yeah, that's the budget. That's what it says on that. Yeah. So there's not even a cut. It's doubled in 5 years, and they don't even cut it. It's just, you know, they increase it a little bit slower than the Democrat budget does, and then they say, oh, this is a vicious cut. You're going to all these This is what we're dealing with.
Children are going to starve and die.
Well, they just
right.
have a
Even
story.
Even though the cuts are for able-bodied working age adults, specifically,
right.
and not for children or the elderly or disabled people, you'll notice Democrats keep talking about those groups, which are not the ones that Republicans are trying to put any requirements on. But, you know, they're more sympathetic, so they just say it.
Yeah, it's interesting. And saying it just doesn't make it true.
No.
That's the thing.
Well, there was a story this morning that $1 out of every $5 in Medicaid right now is fraud. I mean, if they
That's
just...
Right. It was actually more than that. The last year that they did eligibility audits in Medicaid, it was like 24% improper payment rate. And that was the last year that Trump was president, right? And what Biden did to address this is they canceled all the audits. So they stopped checking.
Wow.
So I doubt it went down after they stopped checking.
What? Yeah. Can you imagine?
But they can say, hey, there's no, you know, there's no proof of improper payments because we don't do audits anymore.
Unbelievable.
It just makes people, I mean...
Just makes you crazy. You know, if they just fixed that, they wouldn't need it. They wouldn't need a raise. They'd have more money than they know what to do.
They wouldn't need anything else.
Yeah.
They wouldn't need to do anything else. I mean, look, I know you can't eliminate all improper payments. You know, there's going to be...
Stuff happens.
But if you could cut it in half.
Yeah, just half.
From the Republican budget with no other changes.
But when you have 25%... that are being documented as improper payments. That is.
Right, exactly.
That would be like, take your household budget and put 29% of it out in the yard in a can and bury it and see if you can live on that.
I mean, light it on fire, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And forget where you buried it, I guess. I forgot that part.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah, that's, or move away, better yet. Bury it in the backyard and then move away. Yeah, so all of those kinds of things. So if from the organizations that you work with, how do you see this? How do you guys see this gaming out at this point?
Well,
what's the crystal ball? You can be like Johnny Carson's amazing Kreskin guy.
Well, I mean, look, the president said he likes the House budget, but what he hasn't done yet, and I'm hoping he will do, is he should say, "Hey, Senate, vote on the House budget. You want to amend it, but you can't. But, you know, vote on it. Put it on the floor. Let's get this thing moving." And I think that if we can get a little pressure, especially from the White House, which is obviously the biggest power center in town, if we can get a little pressure on the Senate to act, and we can get some agreement on a budget, I think they could start to move pretty quickly on the actual legislation. We can get this done sooner rather than later. But if they drag it out, and if they insist on we're going to do a budget with no tax provisions, and then circle back to tax in the fall. If that happens, we're looking at, Christmas week and this being done at the last minute and maybe even some horrible negotiated deal with Democrats. And if it even gets done at all, it'll be, with minimum economic benefit because there's going to be all this uncertainty that holds up investment in the meantime. And then Republicans will really suffer come election day next year because the economic benefits are going to be really muted if it plays out that way. So I'm hoping... I'm not really answering whether this will happen, but I'm going to be doing everything I can to make it happen, that we're going to see action in the Senate sooner rather than later, that they'll either vote on the House budget as is or they'll amend it and send it back, but they'll get the process back up and running where we can get a good reconciliation instruction to the tax writing committees and they can get this bill written sooner rather than later. And, in an ideal world, we'll hit the president's target date of Memorial Day. It's going to be hard to get back on track for that at this point, but the idea of slipping into the fall and, God forbid, the winter is a really bad economic.
Yeah, that's a bad mistake.
Outcome.
And it's always the panic,
Yeah, we have to have the pandemonium.
We have to have pandemonium at the last minute. They've had all year to fix it, and let's wait.
Well, there's always something, There's stuff, and there's more stuff, and then you have a lot of people who get ideologically tied up in... It's not perfect. Therefore, we can't move forward. We can't vote on something less than perfect.
Saying, right? They're like, we hate the House budget because we don't think it gets us to permanent.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, I want permanent too, but your budget does nothing on that.
Yeah, let's get us to something.
A 7 or 8 year extension is a lot better than nothing. So, if you want to do permanent, put that in your budget and let's go. But don't tell me you want something better than what the House is doing and then do nothing.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, and the other thing we were going to talk to you about was tariffs, and we didn't get to talk about any of those, and now we have,
I don't know. Tariffs, but that's a whole other thing.
We got like 15 seconds left. So let's pick a new time and talk about tariffs, because we really would like to get smarter about tariffs. There's a ton of misinformation about that, of course. We have run out of seconds, but we really appreciate you coming on.
Time, guys. Have a good one.
Thank you. Thanks, so that was Phil Kirpin from American Commitment. You've been listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.